From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. A North Carolina congressman who's also a medical doctor has an interesting take on the state's response to COVID-19. You'll hear his perspective. Speaking of Congress and COVID-19, another member of North Carolina's delegation questions proposals to send more federal money to the states to deal with public education. You'll learn why. Political debates often focus on inequality. We'll chat with one expert who says people too often overlook the difference between good and bad inequality. And we'll learn why North Carolina will allow something called Medicaid transformation to move forward, despite political disagreements about the government health insurance program. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
In a blow to eastern North Carolina, Duke Energy and Dominion Energy have canceled the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. The 600-mile gas pipeline would have carried low-cost natural gas from West Virginia into Virginia and North Carolina, ending in Robeson County. The Cooper administration's handling of this project has been the subject of much scrutiny by our next guest. Dr. Don Vandervaart is senior fellow at the John Locke Foundation. He is the former secretary of the State Department of Environmental Quality. He served during the Pat McCrory administration. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Are you surprised at this announcement that it's canceled?
I am somewhat. Recently, Duke stated and Dominion stated that they were concerned about the uncertainty of various challenges. And in fact, very recently, the Supreme Court of the United States actually found in their favor on a very important issue about their right-of-way. So
it was moving forward then.
There were other challenges, but that seemed to be one of the more serious ones. And we got to remember that Duke would not have withdrawn from this project if there weren't some issues with the economics of the project. And as you mentioned, first of all, the project would have been a boon to eastern North Carolina. It would have delivered low-cost natural gas to North Carolina in greater supplies, which we need. It would have also provided thousands of very high-paying jobs for the duration of the project. To construct the pipeline. And the additional access to natural gas would have been an economic development tool for eastern North Carolina for various industries.
Did Duke and Dominion specifically say, gee, we're just kind of tired of some of these delays, it's too costly? What was their public announcement?
They're a bit unclear. They talk about the uncertainty, and there's uncertainty of other legal challenges, but there's also uncertainty of the economics. So it's important to understand what the pipeline was and how Duke was going to make money out of it. Remember, the pipeline was being owned half and half by Dominion and Duke. And while no gas, Duke wasn't going to make any money off of gas sales, any gas that Duke Energy was going to purchase from the gas producers in the Midwest, for example, would have been transported through their pipeline, and they would have paid themselves, so to speak, for transportation costs. Now, you can say, is that self-dealing? In fact, Duke needed natural gas, and they're going to have to pay somebody, and it's a very regulated industry, so that's probably not untoward. However, Duke was counting on being able to burn almost all of the natural gas that they were going to push across that pipeline. So the real question is did Duke feel, or is there an uncertain future in combustion of gas for power generation in North Carolina that would make Duke be concerned about whether or not they were going to actually buy as much natural gas as they had planned to buy.
Help us understand why it's so important to North Carolina and the Southeast region to have plentiful access to natural gas.
Really, two reasons. The first reason is that it is a very low cost form of energy right now, thanks to hydraulic fracturing. And so Duke has been burning more and more gas purely based on the cost benefit of using natural gas. So you saw coal plants being retired, in some cases prematurely, because the economics made sense. They were being replaced by baseload natural gas combustion generating plants. The question here is that Governor Cooper has been very strong against, in his clean energy plan, has been strong against continued burning of fossil fuel, including natural gas. So the inescapable question here is whether Duke believed that the Public Utilities Commission, now run by Cooper appointees, was going to allow them to burn the full capacity of the gas that they were anticipating using the pipeline to deliver. And if that weren't the case, if there was something going to change, the economics would make sense. And so that would be a reason enough to walk away. There's nothing that we know about in terms of what's going to happen next. But let's face it, we're all going to pay more. Duke, when faced with adding generation, is mandated by law to provide us the lowest cost. That was natural gas. And when that's taken away for whatever reason, they go to the next lowest cost, which is more. And so we're all going to be paying more for our electricity. There's no question about that.
So this is what is a head scratcher to me, because one would think that Eastern North Carolina, some parts of it are really distressed, as we know. And we hear a lot of conversation, no matter which administration is in power, saying, look, we have to do something to help Eastern North Carolina. There's no way that any household can avoid having a bill for energy. Okay. Absolutely. Electricity, got to be able to turn on the lights. You got to be able to cook, etc. So one would think that if natural gas is lower cost and it is helping, by adopting it, it is helping to retire more, I guess it would be, polluting types of plants. Wouldn't everybody be for this? I'm still trying to figure out why it's not going forward.
The main reason that you can point to is the clean energy plan by Cooper. They view natural gas as problematic as coal. Coal plants are very clean right now, but they still generate greenhouse gases.
Is it because natural gas is coming from fracking? Is that the connection?
No. Well, there's some people that are concerned about fracking in its own right, but no, natural gas in itself is also a greenhouse gas, and it produces CO2, and therefore, the Cooper administration is opposed to large increases in the use of it, and so your premise is entirely correct, unless you are then told, but I don't want any more fossil fuel, then you have to go to the next lowest cost fuel. So we're looking at Duke probably spending a lot of money. That means the ratepayer spending a lot of money on modernizing our grid to allow for more solar, which is more expensive. But that's the next alternative, and I think that is where this is headed. And so, we're going to pay more. Duke's going to do fine. Duke makes money. Remember, they're regulated. They're going to make money whenever they generate electricity. And in fact, they've got a non-regulated division that makes unregulated profits from renewables. So they don't mind renewables in their own right.
So the losers here are really the people of Eastern North Carolina.
Absolutely. The ratepayers and the lost economic development opportunities that natural gas pipeline would have provided.
We've been talking with Dr. Don Vandervaart. He is senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He's been writing about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. You can read all of that work at johnlocke.org. Don, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Greg Murphy brings a different perspective than most members of Congress when it comes to policies for addressing COVID-19. North Carolina's 3rd District Representative is a doctor. He shared his thoughts about the pandemic in a recent Raleigh news conference.
Emotions are running high, understandably so. They range from anything from people being mentally concerned to complacent. To acknowledging that there's a problem going on, to a full-blown panic and fear. I hear constant frustrations from people because the implementations of policies have been charged and seen as goalposts that are being moved constantly, and possible political motivations behind some of the processes. You know, as I've said many times before, in this state, in this nation, on the county level, everywhere, we've literally been building a plane while we're flying it. So I don't know, I'm not here to point out wrong to anything that's been done in the past. I am going to point out opportunities I think that were missed that would have put us in a better place today. You know, we made a lot of assumptions, some of which were correct, some of which were incorrect, and the fact that we've learned so much just in the last several months about this gives us some measure to move forward.
Murphy highlighted a key challenge in addressing COVID-19.
What we face now is a very difficult task, and that's a balancing act. A balancing act between safeguarding the people, their health in this state, while at the same time letting people get their lives back, get back to work, get back to school, get back to church, to seek life's fulfillment. And so I've heard this many times before, that we cannot be so afraid to get sick that we forget how to live. So there are certain things about this pandemic that we must accept, that we cannot change these. And if we check our politics at the front door, work together, then I think we will achieve a much greater outcome.
Murphy describes his approach to COVID-19.
What we do is we treat this entire episode, at least I have, like a sick patient. We gather truths, and it's fully transparent, and it's with full transparency and truthfulness that we best treat our patients. I think this is definitely an area of opportunity that has been missed in our state, and I think it's one that if we embrace moving forward at all levels, transparency and truthfulness, that we will have a much better outcome. You know, when I was young, my mother told me that telling half the truth was really a lie. So we want the whole truth. We want everything out on the table so that people can understand the entire situation. I think we've lost our way a little bit. I think we've wandered from treating this as an entire issue dealing with medical science, and dealing it a little bit more with political science. And what that does, it leads to mixed signals and frustration and division in our state. And it's something, especially during this time of crisis, that we just don't need.
Murphy lobbed one criticism at politicians addressing COVID-19.
There have been many opportunities to seek consensus and communications that we've missed. And I think if we show some consistency in doing that moving forward, we'll be in a much better place. We show consistency in treating groups the same way, businesses the same way, so that we're not picking winners and losers haphazardly. We also need to be transparent in what we do. We can't keep one group differently than another group just because they're of a particular political affiliation.
That's U.S. Representative Greg Murphy, Republican from North Carolina's 3rd District. He's speaking during a recent news briefing in Raleigh. Murphy emphasized one important element of COVID-19 policy.
Communication, as with so many other human interactions, is key to people regardless of which political affiliation that you have. Communication is key to be on the same page and so that people have their opportunity to voice concerns, to offer input, and actually put a unified North Carolina message moving forward in a much better place. We've been on now, if you look at the curves, we've been on a continuous and steady rise in North Carolina over the last 6 to 8 weeks. And I'm going to reiterate a conversation that I had with Dr. Burks when she recalled a conversation with Dr. Cohen. And then she was alarmed at our persistent and steady increase. But she said emphatically that this had nothing to do with the state reopening. There's no spike that happened after the state reopening. This has been a persistent and constant increase, and pointed out that there has been probably a fundamental flaw that has led to this constant increase in what the approach has been so far.
Murphy reminded his audience that the original goal of shutting down the economy was to flatten the curve. That meant pushing some COVID-19 cases off to later dates to avoid overwhelming the healthcare system.
I think it's important that we don't move the goalposts, that we give people a constant expectation of where we are and where we need to be. We've done all the right things, and I supported 100% the closing of the state at the time. In fact, I urged it, because I thought at the time a haphazard county closing wasn't doing any good, and I believe the state did the right thing in closing all businesses down, because we did not know what this virus was about. We didn't know about its R-naught, its infectivity ratio, but obviously as time has occurred, those things have changed.
Murphy turned to his medical experience in assessing COVID-19's impact.
Death is a very difficult thing, an endpoint that we deal with in medicine. I've been in medicine for over 30 years, and unfortunately, it's one of the things of life. We have to deal with death. We have to deal with it in medicine. But it's very important that we look at populations. Who is it most at risk to actually have a bad outcome from this? Not just get sick from it, because, you know, we get sick from colds and other things, but who's most at risk? It is our elderly age group. Okay, 65 to 74-year-old, they have about 20% of the deaths, and we see that two-thirds of the deaths in North Carolina have occurred in 75 and older individuals. Two-thirds. Now, again, this is information that we should have had readily available at the beginning. It should not have required a lawsuit for us to get. This is something that should have been transparent for us to know about. So, you know, guys, the virus, just like any other virus, has an endpoint that we don't like. It shows that people do succumb to the disease, just like HIV, just like H1N1. We had a disproportionate number of individuals who were African American who died. We also, again, had obviously the higher folks of Caucasian North Carolinians died. That's changed a little bit. I will tell you that we really need to do a much deeper dive, because I don't think the pigment in somebody's skin is a problem with this virus itself. It looks to underlying disease states. African Americans have a higher rate of obesity, hypertension, kidney failure, those things which have turned out to be the highest risk factors. And so while it looked like it may be affecting African Americans just by skin color, that's not really the case. It's because of underlying and most likely predisposing disease.
Murphy put COVID-19 nursing home deaths in perspective. Nursing home residents, he reminds us, are already sick.
Their median survival, half of them do not live more than 6 months. So we look at a population that is very, very frail. But unfortunately, that's where our deaths have occurred. And this is going to be in a stark contrast to what another state has done, Florida, for example, and the way they jumped on their nursing homes very quickly. I think we are a little bit behind the eight ball. It's an opportunity, again, for us as we're moving forward and as we're learning now that there are more and more cases that we can really improve upon.
Murphy pointed to good news.
Fortunately, even though we've had numbers of cases that have continued to rise, fortunately, the bad outcome with COVID has continued to fall. And I believe that even today has fallen down even a little further. That's a good sign. It doesn't mean that people are not getting infected. It doesn't mean that people are not getting sick. It means that people, fortunately, are fewer actually succumbing to the disease. So that's a definite good sign for the state of North Carolina.
Murphy recapped his key message.
When the stay-at-home order was given, it was the right thing to do. You didn't know what this virus was going to do or how it was going to act. But I find it very perplexing and troubling, for that matter, to look across the country and you see that with the same data from different states, that we have Republican governors doing one thing and Democratic governors doing another thing. Why is that? There's only one conclusion you can come to, and that's politics. And to be honest with you, that's irritated the living hell out of me since day one on this.
That's North Carolina Congressman Greg Murphy, Republican from the 3rd District. He's also a medical doctor. Murphy recently shared his expert assessment of the state's response to COVID-19. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some members of Congress want the federal government to spend millions more dollars helping public schools cope with COVID-19. But the leading Republican on the U.S. House's Education Committee has concerns. Representative Virginia Fox of North Carolina discussed the issue during a recent meeting on Capitol Hill.
Just as our teachers are working to overcome the many challenges this global pandemic poses, this nation's elected officials must also step up and do the job they were elected to do. The coronavirus pandemic has adversely impacted private and public schools alike. An estimated 94% of public and private schools closed this spring, impacting approximately 97% of the country's students. All students, including those at traditional public schools, charter schools, and private schools, should have access to the tools they need for lifelong success. That is why Congress responded swiftly and enacted the CARES Act, which provided more than $30 billion in emergency education funding to students, schools, institutions, and states. There's been no evaluation of how $30 billion in hardworking taxpayer money has been spent. Yet here we are with Democrats pushing those same taxpayers to dole out more of their hard-earned money at a time when many Americans are being forced to tighten their belts. Given the ever-evolving threat COVID-19 poses, it would be irresponsible to rush to throw additional funds at a problem we don't understand fully. Also, some schools have not yet spent the funds they received from the CARES Act. Despite these facts, Democrats are demanding we spend more money. Money is not a cure-all solution, and it is irresponsible to blindly throw more money at this situation. Let's not forget that history has shown that more spending does not guarantee better outcomes. In fact, per pupil education spending has increased significantly over the years, but high school seniors aren't performing any better than they were 30 years ago. Congress must first evaluate the impact of the billions of dollars in federal taxpayer education aid already provided through the CARES Act before rushing to further burden taxpayers with additional spending. Demanding additional funds at this time is premature and illogical. As we continue to monitor the issues students and schools face, it is within this committee's jurisdiction to explore opportunities for long-lasting reforms.
That's U.S. Representative Virginia Fox of North Carolina's 5th District. She's the top-ranking Republican on the U.S. House's Education Committee. She's sharing her concerns about sending more federal dollars to schools across the country for COVID-19 relief. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week and listen to Headlock too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Especially during an election year, we hear a lot about inequality. That includes ideas for doing something to reduce inequality. These ideas good, bad, counterproductive? Well, our next guest recently helped address those questions in a presentation for the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Robert Waples is professor of economics at Wake Forest University, and his latest book is titled In All Fairness, Equality, Liberty, and the Quest for Human Dignity. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So we really do hear quite a bit about equality, not just in an election year, but especially during an election year. As you tackle this topic, equality, what are the things that you want people to keep in mind?
Yeah. So I thoroughly agree. In fact, I would call it an obsession that we have politically with this. And the danger is that, we could go in the direction of democratic socialism, which is not going to be good for very many people in the economy. So what we try to do in this book and what I'm doing in the talk is kind of focus on the big picture as to, what is equality? Why does it matter? I think inequality is a beautiful thing. I would not want everyone to be equal. I would not want to live in a world of clones. Okay? The differences amongst us, that's beautiful. But of course, it can go too far. And so inequality can be a very nasty thing as well. So what we need, of course, is just that right sweet spot there. And what we try to do in the book is think about good inequality and bad inequality. There's a lot of good inequality out there that arises from us, for example, trading with each other. If you know a little bit of economics, the principle of trade is comparative advantage, right? David Ricardo's idea. If we were all equal, there'd be no point in trading with, there'd be no gains from trading with each other. So those good kind of inequalities from trading voluntarily, exchanging with each other so that we're both better off is what we want to cultivate. But what we want to diminish are the bad kind of inequalities, especially when somebody, you know, uses their clout to play the political system to get some little special favor thrown their way that they're not deserving of.
Now, hearing you discussing inequality, this is the type of discussion that you rarely hear, that there could be good inequality versus bad inequality. Why is it important that people know that not all inequality is created equal?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And so, you know, I think deep down people know that, and they can't imagine living in a world with such complete equality. Because they know that they respond to incentives themselves. And if we're going to level everybody down, things are not going to be very pretty. You won't have an incentive to do things like go and get an education, like go out and work hard. What's going to happen to society? We've seen what happens to societies like that in other countries, you know, Cuba or some country like that. So everybody kind of deep down knows it. But what they want to do is get their slice of the pie bigger. And so many people go out and rent seek, you know, go to the government and try to get a bigger piece of the pie, not by producing more wealth, but just by getting a little more of somebody else's slice. And this happens across the board. It's crony capitalism. It's the bailouts that we saw 12 years ago now. It's those kinds of things that we need to lessen. But it's also like, people campaigning, like, we're going to cancel your college loan debt. Right? I mentioned this to my wife. She just exploded at the idea. I paid my debt off for college. Who are these people? Exactly, right? But somehow this has become politically acceptable to be able to go and through no merit of your own and just kind of go and take things, that you don't deserve from the political system.
We are chatting with Robert Waples, professor of economics at Wake Forest University. His latest book, which covers many of these topics, is titled In All Fairness, Equality, Liberty, and the Quest for Human Dignity. We've been talking about equality and inequality, and as the book title suggests, this is also tied in with liberty. If you're going to address equality or inequality, it is going to have an impact on liberty and potentially a negative impact. So what's the balancing act we need to deal with?
So I guess the key is, you know, what do we mean by liberty? Because like all these words out there that have good meanings, they get captured by somebody and twisted around. And so, you know, liberty, freedom once meant freedom to do good, to lead a good moral life, to do productive things, to help other people out, to gain from exchanging with them. And then freedom has devolved in our recent years. And liberty in so many people's minds is now license. It's that I can do whatever the bleep I want to do. And when you do, you do
Thanks
whatever.
Thanks for the bleep, by
you,
the way.
You do whatever the bleep you want to do is the problem, if that's the way you think about it. And so it's changed from me acting as a freed man does, not as a slave does, into me being able to do whatever I want and not have to live with the consequences. Like going back to the student loan example, right? Going to a school that's far more expensive than you should have, majoring in something that's not going to earn you very much money, and borrowing money from somebody else and, you know, promising you were going to pay them back and then thinking that you should be able to walk away from that scot-free, right? Liberty license. Freedom from responsibility is what too many people seem to want these days. Imagine borrowing your friend's car and say, oh, you want it back? I didn't know you. I actually had to give. When you borrow money, it's kind of the same thing, you know, not being able to just slip out of paying your debts there. I mean, it used to be that freedom and liberty meant to live a good moral life. And our society in so many ways has turned that on its head.
Well, some people are going to hear us and say, we understand what you're saying, but shouldn't we do something about inequality? Yep. Are there things that we can and should do?
Yep. And in fact, we do a lot in this country. A lot of people might not realize this, but we have the most progressive tax system in the world essentially, in this country. Of all the other countries in the OECD, the kind of the rich countries club, we have the most progressive tax system of any. We've got a lot of programs in place tied in with that. For example, a lot of people might not realize the earned income tax credit. This is a subsidy that goes to low-income working people. Okay, so you can't just not have a job. You got to work, and especially when you have dependents, we other taxpayers subsidize workers so that at the peak, if you're working about minimum wage job, full time, and have a dependent, we're going to add roughly 40% to your income. We do things like that a lot in this country that don't really get much press. And in our official poverty statistics, poverty never seems to go away. That's because they don't count these monies as part of your income in poverty. They only count what you earn in the labor market, essentially, and they don't count the transfers you get from the government. Okay, well, then poverty's not going to go away if that's the way you do it. So we do a lot in this country. But one of the main things we can do is just unfetter people, right? Free them to, you know, have their own initiative. And so we've got another example in this country, creeping occupational licensing laws, right? People who want to get into a particular profession need more and more training, more and more certification, even if it doesn't really help them do that job better. And so it's those kinds of freedoms, I think, that we can give people, economic freedoms, that'll allow them to economically flourish as well.
That is the voice of Robert Waples, professor of economics at Wake Forest University. If you'd like to learn much more about this and related topics, the book is titled In All Fairness. Robert Waples, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. After years of debate over how to best serve North Carolinians whose medical needs are covered by the program called Medicaid, Governor Roy Cooper has now signed into law a bill sent to him by state legislators that will transform the Medicaid program, a transformation designed to improve the health of Medicaid patients and to save money as well. Jordan Roberts is following all of the issues related to Medicaid in North Carolina. He is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation and joins me now. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the basis of the change to the program. Mm-hmm. It is going from a program that pays doctors and hospitals for each service that they provide to what?
Yeah, so what you just described is called a fee-for-service, and that's typically how we've paid healthcare providers. But now we're switching to a managed care model where the state will pay managed care organizations, private insurers, essentially, a per-member, per-month rate based on how many Medicaid enrollees they can get within their plan. And then that managed care company uses that per member per month rate, how they see best fit to manage the care of these Medicaid enrollees and try to improve health outcomes and save money on the back end. And the way it works is we give this money to the managed care companies and they have to spend a certain amount of it, and anything above that they can keep as profit, and anything below that they would have to spend on their own.
During the debate over this over the past, half dozen years or so, as we've talked about this here in North Carolina, there had been a concern by those who were opposed to this. They said, well, based on the description you just gave us, how do we ensure that a medical provider will be ethical and have the patient's best interests at heart if there's a profit motive? And tell us about that. How do we ensure that these folks are really going to be caring for people?
Right. So, I mean, I think the biggest thing is that there are oversight and safeguards built into these managed care contracts to make sure that, you know, the managed care companies are meeting all of their standards and metrics that they need to meet. So that's one thing.
So they can't just deny someone.
Exactly.
Sort of treatment.
I mean,
it's
certainly
that.
Happened, but, you know, we're getting better at, you know, managing and overseeing these companies. But, you know, I think the biggest thing is that, you know, what this does is it essentially allows these statewide insurers to compete. And so if a Medicaid enrollee wasn't happy with the care they're getting with one company, there's four statewide companies that got a contract, and they're all essentially competing to provide the best care. So there's really an incentive to get as many Medicaid patients in your plan as possible, and you do that by, you know, providing good care, having the best network, and showing your Medicaid enrollees that, you know, your plan is the best. So there is that that profit motive there, but, you know, that's how we ensure that we have good administration and good management of the plans. But so it just depends on, you know, how much these managed care companies are willing to do.
Jordan, this has been going on for so long. Give us a sense of how this started out. I know that during the Pat McCrory administration, they focused on trying to just shore up the Medicaid program because
right.
it was constantly over budget.
Yeah.
Is that what really started the discussion about, hey, maybe there's a better way to operate this?
Yeah, I think so. So the McCrory administration, a little bit before my time with the Locke Foundation, but during that time, the state was suffering from a lot of Medicaid budget shortfalls. We were spending way more than, you know, we had anticipated, and that was causing problems in the budget. But so that was one reason. But I think the other reason mainly is that the majority of states have switched to this managed care model just to kind of get the state out of this risk-bearing position with the Medicaid patients, because it's a tough population of unique health needs to manage. And so getting this handing that risk over to managed care companies that are experienced in this and have, you know, vast networks and, you know, understand how to manage the care of these folks can be a much more prosperous arrangement for both the state and the patients. So the Medicaid budget shortfalls and just kind of the need for the state to get out of this business and, you know, still provide that care, but allow people who are more specialized in this to handle it.
Tell us a little bit more about the folks who are covered by Medicaid. And sometimes people get confused between Medicaid and Medicare.
Right.
Medicare being the government program for people over the age of 65. Mm-hmm. But Medicaid is much, much different.
Right. So these are going to be, you know, the neediest populations in our state. These are poor children, mothers, the elderly, blind, and some disabled folks. So these are really the people that are most in need of assistance from the state. And so those are the populations that are going to be in this managed care arrangement. Not all of the about 2.2 million Medicaid enrollees will go into managed care. About 1.6 of the total will. That other remaining portion will still remain in fee-for-service, just for reasons that, you know, we don't need to get into here, but it's the majority of the Medicaid patients. And so these are the most needy and at-risk populations in our state.
I ask you that because it has become really important to the discussion of a related but different issue in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are covered by Medicaid, as you described, folks who really need help. They're living on the margins
right.
for one reason or another. There's been a lot of talk about, well, North Carolina should expand the population that is mm-hmm. allowed to be covered by Medicaid. The John mm-hmm. Locke Foundation, and you in particular, have been writing a lot about this over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
North Carolina has not expanded Medicaid as it could under Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us why not.
Well, you know, the main reason why I think myself and a lot of people in the legislature have been against this policy is just the vast expansion of you know, government of government health care. We provide this service to the neediest populations because, you know, that's what we should do. And, you know, we should help these folks. But, you know, there has to be a cutoff, a limit. And, you know, just the Affordable Care Act allowed us to expand up to 138% of the federal poverty line. And so, you know, what we believe is that, you know, there are other solutions that we can used to help these folks that are uninsured or struggle to afford their current health insurance, to help them get that without expanding, the government scope of healthcare. And so, you know, this Medicaid transformation, very different than Medicaid expansion. This was, you know, some of the political back and forth. Those on the left said we should expand Medicaid, and those on the right said, you know, we should move it to a managed care organization. But, you know, very, very different populations. And, we want to provide for the neediest in our state, and Medicaid transformation, you know, getting it into a managed care is one way that we could possibly do that.
Yeah, two different issues, but I think it's so fascinating about how the discussion has kind of overlapped at times about that. Governor Roy Cooper is a big proponent of adding 500,000 to 600,000 more people to the Medicaid rolls. And you've written eloquently, Jordan, about the profile of those people that would be added. Many of them would have many other options, able-bodied working people.
That's right. Yeah. And so, you know, that's why it was interesting to see Governor Cooper sign this, because that was his biggest sticking point, was that, you know, saying to Republicans at the legislature, if you guys want your Medicaid transformation, your privatization of Medicaid, then you're going to have to expand it for me. And, you know, that's that was interesting to see play out. And, you know, I'm glad the governor signed that bill so we can get this going.
Jordan, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.